people of North Korea have never been told that the United States landed a man on the moon, they believe that they are the chosen people of the purest race, and their calendar marks time as beginning with the birth of their first leader, Kim Il-sung. Although its people are largely ignorant of what's happening in the rest of the world, outsiders know nearly as little about life inside North Korea. It's a nation-state shrouded in mystery, and jokes and folklore have been filling the information void. In his book, The Impossible State, North Korea, Past and Future, Victor Cha, the former director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council, offers the most comprehensive picture of North Korea possible from its beginnings after World War II up to the present. Mr. Cha was on our show this past April, and we thought we would re-air that conversation for you today on this 4th of July. I began by asking him, is the phrase the impossible state a description for North Korea that you've come up with?
Well, yes, we came up with it largely because it is, you know, we've seen the Soviet Union fall, we've seen all of these regimes in the Arab Spring come apart, and yet, you know, amidst all this, you still have North Korea, this impossible state.
Well, there are other states that are called failing states, like Zimbabwe, and that state seems to be held up by spit and chewing gum. What about this?
Well, I think that would also describe, in a sense, North Korea, in that it is a very fragile dictatorship. But I think what distinguishes this place and makes it truly impossible is that they are being held together by, as you said, chewing gum and scotch tape, but at the same time, they are building the most powerful weapons in the world.
The picture we get from our media is that North Korea is a starving, desperate country, but didn't it have a thriving economy after World War II? It was more industrialized than the South, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's a very good point. You know, after, you know, when the Japanese first colonized Korea at the beginning of the 1900s, all of the mineral resources and the industry and the heavy manufacturing was all done in the northern part of the peninsula.
So why was that? Was it better for the ports?
Well, it was because the South is still the breadbasket of the country, and the North has all the mineral resources. And so that when the Korea emerged from the end of the Japanese occupation and the end of World War II, it was probably one of the most advanced post-colonial societies in Asia.
So what changed it, the Korean War?
Well, the Korean War leveled everything. I mean, the U.S. leveled everything with carpet bombing. But then the Chinese and the Russians worked very hard to rebuild. And the North Koreans, of course, had the technological know-how already. So in that 3 decades after the end of the Korean War, the North Koreans were doing fairly well. You know, CIA estimates found that the North per capita income and manufacturing levels were higher than that of the South really up until the 1970s.
Well, the South had its own problems. It had an authoritarian government, which was kept it from producing. But I suspect also the major boom in Asia in general, it benefited from what was happening in Japan that spilled over into Taiwan and South Korea.
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly part of it. I mean, the big mistake they made was that as they were building on this base, industrial base that they had already had, they started devoting more and more of their resources towards the military and towards propping up this cult of personality leadership and not to innovation and not to export. And that's when the economy starts grinding to a halt in the 80s.
And they seem to be totally skewed. Some of the things I see in documentaries are these incredible spectaculars that are created, I guess, to impress foreigners. I can't imagine what else. That must cost millions of dollars to maintain. People devote large portions of their life to working on them.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right, Leonard. You know, when I made a trip there, when I was working in government, I remember going to a meeting at the foreign ministry and seeing these kids coming out of school, you know, late afternoon, and then coming back after that meeting and then seeing them all walking, marching in work units to the main square to practice these sorts of dances and everything. So I think it's both a way to maintain this image of a very disciplined state, but it's also to train the minds of these people so they think about nothing else.
And it's all part of the cult of personality. They're doing it to please their beloved leader or whatever the official title is at any given time.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's no psychic space, I think, in the North Korean mind for anything except serving the state.
Does the cult of personality go all the way back to the beginnings of North Korea?
Well, you know, I think in the beginning when the Soviets occupied the northern part of the peninsula, Stalin picked the first leader of North Korea. And he was largely, I think, a secular leader. And it was really his son, Kim Jong-il, the second leader of North Korea, as he was vying for the position of being the next successor, that really started building this cult of personality, basically to gain favor among the other possible successors to Kim Il-sung.
But it almost takes on a religious significance for Koreans, doesn't it? There are pilgrimages to where the beloved leader was born, and there are statues all over the place extolling these guys.
That's right, and a lot of that was built in the 70s and 80s, as Kim Jong-il, the second leader, was trying to cement his position. And, you know, there is no religion in North Korea. There is only worship of the Kim family, and that basically replaces religion.
And what religion was there before? In the South, it's there's a fair amount of Christianity.
Oh,
what
sure.
else?
Yeah, I mean, in the South now, about 25% of the population is Christian, 25% Buddhist. In the 19th century, Korea and the Philippines were the two most successful places for Western missionaries, including the northern part of the peninsula.
Is North Korea the only place where the Cold War continues?
I think for the most part it is. President Obama was just there at the DMZ for the first time. I think it was probably made a very deep impression on him. Anybody who's gone there and has seen this very militarized border, he said it looked like a time warp out of the Cold War, and I think that's right.
Well, they still operate under a siege mentality, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Forward deployed 1.1 million man military on the border, facing the South, and they basically justify the political control at home and the ideology of the state in terms of these external threats.
Is that why they built up their military to such a high degree? It's a way of forestalling invasion?
I think that's certainly part of it. I think the other part of it is, from their perspective, we have to understand that they live with, a very threatening, in their own minds, a very threatening example of prosperity and democracy right across the border in South Korea. And so that, I think, is very threatening to them on a daily basis.
But North Korea received a good deal of support from China and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. It was actually a pretty good time for North Korea, wasn't it?
Yes. During the Cold War, they were doing quite well. And in many senses, they felt like time was on their side. And it was really from the 1980s, as you talked about, as we had the boom in Asia among these tigers, and South Korea's moves towards democratization, that you really start seeing a gap that becomes insurmountable between the two.
Now, why were China and the Soviet Union so willing to give so much to North Korea when they knew that they were unlikely to see any return of that money?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think part of it had to do with the politics between China and the Soviet Union at the time during the Cold War. You know, there was the Sino-Soviet split. And in many ways, North Korea became a very important coveted prize between the two as they competed for leadership of the communist movement in Asia. So they both worked very hard at trying to lure the North Koreans to their side.
And what did the North Koreans do? Were they able to play that game?
Yeah, Kim Il-sung was a master at playing the two off of each other. And so if Khrushchev criticized North Korea's economic plans, then the North Koreans would lean towards the Chinese. When Mao went into the Cultural Revolution, they leaned back towards the Soviets, and they just played off the two for 25, 30 years.
Did the cult of personality grow out of admiration for what Stalin had done? It's before Mao, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, to an extent, but I think in many ways it was an indigenous creation in North Korea, largely having to do with the domestic politics of the country.
My guest is Victor Cha. His book, The Impossible State, North Korea, Past and Future. Today, per capita GDP in North Korea is just under $1,000. South Korea's GDP is nearly 22 times higher. So how did North Korea come to be such an extreme economic failure?
Well, I think they made many mistakes in the process, but perhaps the most important mistake was, this was a country that had a pretty good industrial and manufacturing base to start with.
And you say natural resources.
And natural resources. And what they should have done was export a lot of that to make hard currency so that they could buy food. But they chose not to do that. They chose to be self-sufficient both in terms of industry and in terms of food, which was an impossible combination.
Driven by their political ideology?
Driven by political ideology, the sort of self-reliance, what they, in Korean, what we call juche ideology, was certainly a big part of it. And that made it very difficult for them to accept change or economic reform or opening. And it's the same problem they face today. They're not willing to do it.
You also attribute the country's failed economy to what you call Olympic envy of the 1980s. What do you mean by that?
Well, in 1988, the South Koreans worked very hard to win the bid for the Summer Olympics. And the 1988 Olympics was important because it was the first Olympics after Moscow and Los Angeles in which the entire world was participating because of the two boycotts by the superpowers. And it was also South Korea's big coming out party to show the world what they had achieved in terms of their economy and in terms of their politics. And so for the North Koreans, this was the ultimate threat to their legitimacy on the peninsula, which caused them to engage in five mega economic projects, all of which failed fantastically.
And then the Soviet Union fell.
And then the Soviet Union collapsed.
And did China fill the gap?
Well, China did temporarily, but then in 1992, China normalized relations with South Korea and essentially made the decision that they were not going to continue to subsidize North Korea.
But even earlier, we hear all these crazy stories, for example, kidnappings in Japan, assassinations on foreign soil, soldiers sneaking into South Korea. It always seemed to be working on the rather renegade level.
Yeah, no, those are all very astute observations. I think that there was an aspect of this country that you could describe, particularly during the Cold War, as terrorist. I mean, they were abducting not just their own citizens who were abroad, but foreign nationals.
They abducted, as I said, a whole bunch of Japanese people and had them teach Koreans how to act like Japanese so that they could smuggle them into Japan.
That's right. And one of those operations resulted in an assassination attempt against the South Korean president and killed not the president, but killed the wife of the president. And the daughter of that person is now a likely presidential candidate in South Korea for the elections in December.
You mentioned juche, instrument of internal control that was developed during the Cold War. Can you explain it in more detail?
Well, it's sort of translated literally, it means self-reliance. But what I think the operating definition of the ideology is essentially that North Korea, as a small independent state, feels that its most important thing is to maintain independence and freedom of action. And that means not relying on anybody else and not becoming politically dependent on anybody else, as opposed, again, in their eyes, as opposed to South Korea, which has been, in their eyes, entirely reliant on the United States and hosting foreign troops on their soil. That is the antithesis of what North Korea wants to be.
But it seems like it was almost a conscious attempt at withdrawing from the rest of the world. For example, the Juche time involves a revised calendar that marks the beginning of history as 1912, the year of Kim Il-sung's birth.
That's right. And so April 15th, a couple of weeks from now, 2012, marks the 100-year anniversary. But I think you're right. I mean, they created in their own minds and with the confines of their own sovereign borders a new reality that was totally self-serving for the state and for this leadership.
But Juche must have worked to some degree or else it couldn't have lasted so long.
Yeah.
What drove it? You say partly Kim Il-sung's extreme confidence?
Yeah, I mean, I think it worked for them in part because of the Soviets and the Chinese helping them a great deal. But it also worked because, again, in their own minds during the Cold War, they were in the lead. And therefore, while they were getting fully supported by the Soviet Union and China, South Korea was suffering through military dictatorships and difficult relations with the United States ally. So they really thought time was on their side.
My guest is Victor Cha, who is the former director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council, where he served as an advisor to the president from 2004 to 2007. He's written a book called The Impossible State, North Korea, Past and Future, published by Echo. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But then came disaster, and people were starving. But you've termed North Korea's current behavior as neo-Juche revivalism. So why would they return to something that eventually led to disaster?
I think it's because they don't know anything else that's better. They tried to go through a period of reform in the early 2000s that failed miserably, largely because they weren't willing to cross the gap and do real reform. And so they have again suffered terrible economic problems and food shortages. And the, you know, with a country like this, they have to find a new ideology for this new leadership. And the only thing they know was what succeeded during Kim Il-sung.
But Kim Jong-un, the new leader, was educated in the West. He was educated in Switzerland. Often they bring back new ideas, ways of reviving their country, if not totally changing it over. Are we likely to see that here? Or is do you think that he has to actually become more conservative to consolidate his hold on power?
Yeah. Well, you know, so we think he spent a couple of years of secondary school.
Oh, we think he did.
We've had some newspaper reports, but we think he spent a couple of years in Switzerland at a school in Bern, where he took courses in politics, comparative politics, and parties and elections, and these sorts of things. And I think, you know, up until a couple of weeks ago, there were a lot of theories that this young fellow may be different. And this was largely based on the agreement that had been reached with the Obama administration at the end of February. But this recent announcement of a missile/satellite launch has really kind of undercut a lot of these theories that he may be a wholly different type of person. And, you know, in brittle dictatorships, if you have a young, untested leader, the chances are that they're going to be tougher, not softer, as they try to consolidate power.
As we're seeing to some degree in Syria, even though Assad has been in power for a while, he is the son of the great man.
That's right.
Victor Cha is my guest. His book, The Impossible State, North Korea, Past and Future. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Victor Cha, the former director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council. He was on our show in April to talk about his book, The Impossible State, North Korea, Past and Future. Listeners told us they found the interview fascinating, and we're re-airing it for you today. I opened the second part of our conversation by asking him, when you were working in Washington, were people mostly confused as to how to deal with North Korea?
Well, I think it was a combination of confusion and frustration because successive administrations have been trying to deal with this problem with very little success. But yet the threats were very real.
Well, it was one of the three members of the axis of evil that George Bush talked about, but the one least likely to have any war with because it was the one that would most likely be able to put up a really good fight.
Yeah, I mean,
they have succeeded in some ways, despite all the hardships they've endured, in preventing the United States and other countries from doing anything about their dictatorship.
Well, I think the one thing that has been stable on the Korean Peninsula since the 1950 to 53 war is that we haven't had a reignition of hostilities. You know, the war never ended. There is no peace treaty. There is only an armistice. And so deterrence has held on the peninsula, that's for sure.
Now, the approach to other countries like Burma, Myanmar, seems to finally have had some impact. But would applying the same kinds of sanctions on North Korea have much of an impact? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the Burma example really, I think, is interesting to watch and you wonder what the North Koreans are thinking as they watch what is happening in Burma. To me, what's so interesting about this is that, you know, in Burma, you essentially have a secular leadership, military generals, some of whom have horrible records in the past, but they realize, you know, the practical problems that they face, really, I think, from Cyclone Nargis. and that they are really trying to turn over a new leaf. And these elections are just fascinating to watch. In North Korea, I think the problem is you may have generals like that that exist in the North Korean system. We don't know, but you may. But on top of all that is this non-secular cult of personality leadership in which they devote a tremendous amount of time and resources to legitimating these myths about these leaders. And that is the biggest distraction in the country.
But the myths work both ways, don't they? Kim Jong-il may have been considered the most important figure on earth for the North Korean people, mm-hmm. but he was an object of derision in the West.
Yes, and he...
Were we misreading him?
No, he certainly was an object of derision, whether it was, you know, in movies or on the cover of The Economist magazine or these sorts of things. But the North Korean people never see any of that. They have no access to the internet, to phones, even international phone calls. They have TV. They don't have any access to any of these things.
And they had no idea that he was spending millions of dollars on what has been called a decadent lifestyle. He would... bring Italian chefs in to cook them meals?
Yes. He had many excesses, including trying to bring the greatest chefs and the greatest foods and wines from all over the world.
Despite the fact that his own citizens were starving.
Yes.
He also, as you said earlier, played a major role in the deification of his father. Did he do that because it helped him or just because he deified his father to some degree?
I think it was a combination of the two. I mean, I think he was doing it for his own political future, but he was also doing it because he wanted his father to be remembered as the greatest leader ever. And, you know, according to the North Korean system, Kim Il-sung is still the eternal president of the country.
And it was under his guidance that it became a nuclear power, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, it was under...
So Kim Jong-il is just... continue the policies of his father.
Yeah. I mean, they started with an experimental reactor from the Soviets under Kim Il-sung. But, the big legacy that Kim Jong-il, the recently departed leader, left for North Korea was the massive advancements they've made in terms of their nuclear weapons programs.
And where did the money come from?
They have been involved in a lot of state-backed illicit activities, including counterfeiting... the U.S. $100 note, cigarettes, drugs, that have all gone to finance this this proliferation and this weapons development.
So if I have a $100 note, is it possible that it might be a counterfeit from North Korea?
It's possible. I mean, they have found some of these in circulation in Atlantic City, which is not far from here. The FBI and the Secret Service refer to these as the super note because North Korea somehow acquired the exact same printing press, ink, and paper that the U.S. $100 bill is made from. But this, since it's a new press, there are no imperfections in it. So that's why it's called the supernote. It's actually better than the authentic $100 bill.
Now, you mentioned that we don't know about varying opinions within the ruling group. We do know that there were attempts to apply ideology to the economy that turned out to be rather disastrous, and heads did roll, didn't they?
Yes, I mean they have made mistakes in the past, and the way on their economic planning, and the way they generally deal with that is they find a scapegoat, a minister. And they bring him out and they execute him.
They said that he was the man who pushed it through and it was a big mistake. But have they adjusted again? Is the economy being run any more efficiently today?
No, not at all. I mean, you had this really interesting incident in 2009 where they did a redenomination of the currency that was largely meant to wipe out the savings of a lot of entrepreneurial North Koreans. And the public, unlike in the past, really revolted against that. They were very unhappy with that, and that's why they executed this one minister. But this, you know, to me, what is most important about the future of North Korea is how the North Korean people think about their own livelihood, and the more they start to develop these informal markets rather than relying on government rations, you know, the better chance you have of change in this country.
Well, there have been attempts to clamp down on them, and now they're being allowed again.
Well, there are government-run markets that are being allowed, but there are a lot of informal markets that are springing up. And you know, the market, once you introduce it into a society, it's impossible to completely exterminate it. And it was introduced into the society when they were having the famine, because when there was a famine, then the government wasn't giving out anything. The people had to fend for themselves, and they started selling anything they could for food.
Do we have a sense of how much discontent there might be in North Korea?
We just hear these isolated stories, in part because there's so little access into the country. I mean, I think now they have one. The Associated Press, I think, has an office in there, but we don't know how much access they have around the country. So we have anecdotal evidence that people are upset, but we have nothing really resembling a critical mass of information.
And then we do have people who are trying to slip into China.
Yes.
Some stay, not always. If you're a woman, it's not always a good situation
for
you.
That's right.
Some actually wind up being able to make it all the way down China and into South Korea. But the great majority are shipped back, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, most of these people, they come through China, as you said, and the Chinese government has an agreement with the North Koreans to send many of them back. China considers them to be economic migrants.
Not refugees.
And so there have been a lot of sweeps that the Chinese have done, largely going after men. And because of that, now the refugee flows tend to be more women, which leaves a lot of space for human trafficking, and there's a lot of that on the border now. But from the ones who do make it across, we do get a glimpse of what life is inside of North Korea. It's not a pretty picture.
And there have been a couple of high-level defections, haven't there?
Yes, there have been a couple.
How much did we learn from those people?
We learned a lot. I think from one of them, this fellow Hwang Jung-yup, who defected a while ago, who was a very important person in terms of the North Korean ideology. The North Koreans tried to assassinate him after he defected. He did come to Washington and gave a talk that we actually hosted a couple of years ago, but he has since passed.
Have more people been allowed in? There was a time when it was really hard to even visit North Korea. Mm-hmm. But today I've seen some films, some documentary filmmakers have been there. Of course, Madeleine Albright went in 2000, and that at that time seemed like a major breakthrough.
Right.
Do you think that they are less concerned about being contaminated by Westerners visiting?
You know, I think that they are probably more concerned now, again, because they have this new, young, untested leadership at a very critical transition in their country's history. I mean, they never expected Kim Jong-il to die of a massive heart attack last December. They thought he would live at least another 10 or 15 years. So it's a very difficult time for them now, and I think they are very careful about how much of the outside world they want their people to know about.
Now, you mention, when North Korea collapses, the gulags will be revealed as one of the worst human rights disasters in modern history. How many of these prison camps are there in the country?
There are a number of them. They've consolidated them, but the numbers of people are, you know, in the hundreds of thousands that are estimated to be in these prison camps. And they are largely people who are seen to be disloyal. Or who have grandfathers or grandmothers who were seen to be disloyal. I mean, it's one of these societies where you can get a knock on the door in the middle of the night and get everything taken from you and thrown into a gulag.
Well, that was the same sort of thing that happened in Stalin's time.
That's right.
To some degree during Mao as well.
That's right.
You could be contaminated simply by your family's history.
That's right, yeah.
So this is following how much is North Korean communism pure communism, old-line communism? How much of it is a North Korean variant?
Well, I think it does obviously exhibit communist and socialist characteristics. I think they define themselves as a socialist state. But the ideology of Chuche and this this cult of personality is certainly something that's far beyond what Stalin or even what Mao did.
Really?
Yeah.
After Kim Jong-il's death in 2011, his youngest son is the one who took power. Doesn't Confucian tradition dictate that the oldest son inherits the family business?
That's right. That's normally the way it goes. And we know of three sons that he's had. And the first son, for a variety of reasons, including a well-publicized attempt to go to Disneyland in Tokyo with his family, for which he was detained and deported, led them to not really see him as having leadership material. So this fellow now lives in Macau in China and kind of just lives his own life there.
But he hasn't talked about what's going on back home and not revealed much about how the power struggles have developed?
No, I mean, you know, there are a number of Japanese journalists that follow him around, and apparently he's made some comments about how he didn't think that they could maintain this family leadership after the death of his father, which was very surprising for him to say. But I think, you know, he doesn't have much access into the country now either. But that was pretty revealing to hear him say something like that.
Now, you mentioned that you visited Pyongyang on a trip as a National Security Council staff member in 2007. Mm-hmm. Were you only in the capital city? You have any sense of what life is like outside of Pyongyang?
Yeah. We were in the capital city to negotiate the return of these POW MIA remains from the Korean War, six sets of remains. And so we got to see the city of Pyongyang, but then we also had to drive these remains from Pyongyang to the DMZ and then walk them across into South Korea. So I did get to see some of the country outside of Pyongyang. And Pyongyang looks like any communist city.
Except it has fewer cars.
Fewer cars, but these big, wide thoroughfares, very, you know, communist-like architecture, official architecture. But outside the city of Pyongyang, it's truly a wasteland.
Now, there were some defectors during the Korean War and some POWs who chose to stay as well. Does the United States have any policy in regard to them?
Well, there was one very well-publicized case of this fellow Jenkins who was doing night patrols and actually defected into North Korea. And he eventually came back. He was
married to a Japanese woman.
One of the people who were abducted by the North Koreans from Japan, and he eventually came back and was dishonorably discharged. I can't recall if he was charged with desertion, but he didn't have to really serve any prison time, and now the family lives in Japan.
So. The United States has. Gotten involved in the politics of Syria. We are constantly protesting what's going on in Iran, less so in the case of North Korea. Is it simply because we've written it off or because North Korea has nuclear weapons and we're afraid that if we stir things up too much, they might invade South Korea or send a missile over to Japan?
Yeah, I think the hesitance in part has to do with the unpredictability of the regime, but I also think it has to do with the fact that over the years, successive administrations, this issue just hasn't registered highly on the national security agenda, like Iran or like Syria. It's not Afghanistan, Iraq, the Middle East peace process. These sorts of things register very high for every administration. And in some ways, that's been North Korea's greatest strategic asset. They can kind of muddle through, continue to slowly build their nuclear programs, and hope that the United States tries to react to every crisis by just putting it on a negotiation track. And that's what we've seen.
Well, what they've done often is they've promised to pull back. And then when the West says, okay, let's talk, then suddenly they stop it all.
Right.
After a while, don't people start mistrusting you when they're trying to negotiate with you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody trusts North Korea today. But I think, you know, for the United States and for every administration, the question is, you know, do you really want to confront this mistrust and really try to find a final solution for this? Or is this just too big a task at the moment and you just want to park it somewhere? And I think often administrations have chosen to park the issue.
Despite its tremendous military spending and some reckless adventures, what do you think has kept North Korea from engaging in a real war? I mean, since the Korean War, they did invade the South.
Yeah. Well, I think they're not interested in war. I mean, I think what they're really interested in is being accepted in the international community as a nuclear weapons capable state, They want to have political relations with the United States and with Japan and with others, but they want to do so on their own terms, which means that with the security of nuclear weapons. And that, for us, is just not acceptable.
Well, you write that the once taboo topic of Korean unification is now discussed more openly than ever. In North Korea?
No, I don't think so. In North Korea, it's a survival game. But I think in and around around North Korea, in South Korea, and in other places, I think there is more talk. I mean, given the situation in North Korea, a young, untested leadership, economic problems, food problems, you know, there's more talk about this being, you know, potentially something that could happen, you know, in the next few years.
Well, it would be in its best interest economically, but could North Koreans psychologically handle unification after years of indoctrination and brainwashing?
Very difficult. I think it would be very difficult, much more difficult than what we saw in Germany, just because there was much more interaction between the East Germans and the rest of the world than the North Koreans. So this would be a very, very difficult adjustment. And we see that when we look at the defectors who've tried to assimilate into South Korean society, a very fast-paced society. They have much higher dropout rates in school, very low income levels relative to the South Korean population. So it would be a very difficult adjustment.
It's almost the sort of thing we see when people leave cults that have lived in fortress-like situations.
Yeah, fortress-like is a good way to explain it. I mean, they get slapped with a dose of reality. I mean, the Korean government has a training program, a re-education program for them, subsidized by the government. And they do fairly well in that, but when they're released into society, it's often very difficult for them to keep their heads above water.
You've called your final chapter "The End is Near." Do you really believe that the North Korean state will collapse or that unification might actually be possible?
You know, I think that with this sort of question, we always have to look at what are the conditions under which this thing could come tumbling down. And to me, there have always been three conditions. One is the sudden death of the current leadership.
He's just a kid.
I mean, the sudden death of the current leadership, meaning his father, the guy who just died in December, and continued economic and food problems. And that confluence of factors is there right now. And so,
yeah, but it's been there for a while, and people were starving to death. They knew that the situation was awful, but they had been convinced that it was worse in the rest of the world. So they have learned to live with it.
I mean, I think to an extent there are similarities to the mid-1990s period where they did suffer a famine and Kim Il-sung died. But the big difference this time, I think, is that this young fellow really has had only months to prepare for the job, while Kim Jong-il had 20 years to prepare for the job. The other is that North Korean society is just different now. I mean, when they suffered famine in the 1990s, they didn't know anything else. But now they know more about markets. Now they know a little bit more about what's going on in the outside world. The border with China is very porous. And so they're developing an independence of mind now that didn't exist in the 1990s.
And hearing more about what goes on in the rest of the world.
That's right.
Are they aware at all of the Arab Spring?
I can't imagine that they're not. I mean, it's very difficult for them not to have heard in some fashion through Radio Free Asia or Voice of America or through other means about what has happened in the Arab Spring.
On the other hand, if the leadership feels threatened, do you think that they might do something rash?
Well, I think they're going to clamp down more and more on their society. And to me, this is the fundamental tension. They're going to clamp down more on society because of the Arab Spring and some of these other things. Meanwhile, this society is becoming much more independently minded. And that is going to at some point pull the place apart. We don't know when, but at some point, and again, these conditions have not been there before.
It has caused a lot of trouble in South Korea because there are people who are really pushing for unification. At times, they're seen almost as traitors to South Korea. But aren't they the only hope for some kind of unification?
Yeah. In the end, if this thing does come crumbling down, I mean, the primary burden will fall on the South Koreans. Others will help. The United States will help for certain. But it's the South Koreans.
And that's what happened with West Germany.
Right.
They wound up bearing the biggest burden after unification.
That's right.
Victor Cha is former director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council, where he served as an advisor to the president from 2004 to 2007. His book, The Impossible State, North Korea, Past and Future, published by Echo. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.